We are on location once again, so this time we're at...
The Women in Rail Awards 2024 at the Camden Roundhouse.
And so this is our proud thing that we're going to try and start every podcast. Is it on location? Is this the new thing now?
Yeah, because apparently we get around, don't we, Tony?
Every time we rock up together to everything now. So we've been meeting some interesting people tonight, and we think we've got some future guests for podcasts coming up as well.
Apparently people have listened, people are interested, and they're up for being on the podcast.
Excellent. So now we're on to episode 5, and let's go and do it somewhere more quietly than in this big party. And you've been drinking anyway, so it's not the time for a serious discussion, is it? Let's go and have a good evening, and over to episode 5.
Yeah, my feet are sore. Let's sit down. Welcome to Parallel Lines. We are here in Manchester on what is so far one of the hottest days of the year. So we're in Manchester Victoria in one of the offices above the station. So the bit that you don't get to see very often, old railway office with questionable air conditioning that you might be able to hear. So apologies for that.
And a big, 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 big thank you to Northern for finding us somewhere to do this, because we'd got everything planned except the place to record it. So I'm really grateful to them for stepping in and finding us somewhere to do this.
And everything planned includes, we have a very prestigious guest to join us today on the podcast, who is pulling a face at me for using the word prestigious, but I'm going to use it anyway. So I will let her introduce herself, but this is a former big boss of mine, is how I would describe this lady. So Jo Kay, thanks for coming on and talking about the RBF. What wording do we use? Chief Exec?
So I'm the Chief Exec of the Railway Benefit Fund, which is the working name for the Railway Benevolent Institution. And before that, did many things inside Network Rail, running the West Coast, doing some of the West Coast upgrade, trying to write the National Railway timetable and a variety of other things.
I'm going to dive in here. Before Jo talks to us, the president of the Railway Benefit Fund, Pete Waterman, was on a charter train that was raising a fantastic amount of money for the Railway Benefit Fund a couple of weeks ago, and I spoke to him about RBF and his take on things.
Well, it looks after the staff, and that's important, because... you know, there are lots of charities, but we just look after people that are railwaymen or railway people. It's changed a lot since lockdown. So when I first became president, we did things like we bought fridges for widows that husbands had worked on the railways that hadn't been part of the, you know, the British Rail Pension Fund. So they'd run short of money, so we would buy fridges or we would pay for a funeral. It all changed with COVID, and where we would have one call every 24, 25 minutes, we get a call every 8 minutes now. And we're seeing people that have worked on the railway actually living in their cars or in their vans, you know. And not everybody on the railway is earning big money. And there's still people on the railway that are doing flexible hours and struggling. So, you know, we're there. And they can't go to the companies because they don't want to be seen to be a problem to the company, but they can come to us and we can, you know, do something about it. And sometimes we can go to the company and get the help from them.
And the thing, despite all the things that have happened over the last 25 years, the railway is still a family, isn't it? It still cares about its family members, or well, it tries to care about them.
Yes, I think it, I mean, that's why I became, I'm to me, the railway community is a family, and I'm very proud of that family. I've been, you know, I started on the railway in 63. And I've been travelling every week on the railway since 1968. So it's always been good to me. It's always been looked after. And I get fed up with people knocking the railway all the time. They obviously haven't travelled on the motorways this week, because the motorways this week have been an absolute bloody nightmare. And so if any complaints about the railway, forget it.
We did the intro from the Women in Rail Awards, which is another part of the railway family that people don't always get to see. In a previous episode, we were live from the Railway Children's Sleep Out, so another kind of behind-the-scenes thing, and we'd really just like to hear a bit more about the RBF and why it's there, what it does, because I have to say, as a railway person, third generation, married to a railway man, I don't know that much about it, if I'm honest. I know it's there and it's good, and it's kind of this thing that exists in the background, and I guess you kind of hope you'll never need it, but so many people do. So Tell us a bit about it, Jo.
The Railway Benefit Fund has been around for nearly as long as the railways, actually. We were founded in 1858. And back then, as I'm sure your listeners will appreciate, the railway was a lot more of a dangerous place than it was. Lots of people died either in the construction or the operation of the railways. And a group of well-meaning individuals came together to create a support mechanism for the families of those who had been killed or injured on the railway. And over time, we've been associated with orphanages, so railway servant orphanages in Derby and similarly at Webb House in Crewe. But the modern form of the organisation is as a benevolent charity. So we provide financial support and assistance to those who work in the industry. And it's a very broad church, so that encompasses all of the sort of traditional TOCs and Network Rail, but also all of the supply chain. And we try and help people by mainly giving out financial grants, but also signposting them to other support and activities that may help them when they fall upon difficult times. We also like to try and assist those who've left the railway family. So we are a charity for those who are active in the industry, but also those who are former rail workers and those who are retired. So that's what we do. And we do that through having a casework team who deal with applications. And we support all of that through fundraising. We're not a membership organisation. We rely entirely upon donations, and that's why we arrange events a bit like the charter train that Pete was on when you interviewed him, as a mechanism for raising the funds that we need to support the widest number of people that we can in the railway family.
Look, the industry's known. I think if you read the papers, the popular papers and media, you would hear about things like, oh, you know, train drivers get paid so much money and they're always on strike and arguing about rest days, and has a reputation for being a really well-remunerated industry. But as Pete kind of alluded to in that recording, that's not the case for everyone, is it? If you're encompassing the whole supply chain in particular, there's some things in there that really don't come with those benefits that I might have always enjoyed, for instance, I've been fortunate enough to. So what kind of issues are involved that people might not have thought of being associated with, you know, railway workers?
So you're right. I think the industry does suffer a bit from this perception that everybody in it is really well paid. And clearly that's true in some roles. But there's also a large proportion of it that isn't the case. In the supply chain, there are those who clean the trains, present the trains, work in the catering, work behind the scenes in lots of places. And those jobs aren't as well paid. But even for those who are well paid, the challenges that we've all faced over the last few years have meant that lots of people have been just about managing, but are only one financial issue away from not managing.
Yeah.
So it takes one massive bill for an unexpected car repair or one relationship breakup, and the very carefully constructed financial situation they've got can fall apart quite quickly. And so we see applications from absolutely everybody in the industry. We see most of our applications coming from those who are active in the industry, and that's a real difference for us from the situation, say, 5 years ago. I think, as Pete said in his piece, you know, we did used to have a lot of applications from the retired, and we would be doing home adaptations for those who were starting to struggle with mobility. But actually now 2/3 of our money goes to people who are active in the industry, and most of those people have got full-time, full-on, frontline jobs on the gate line, on trains, on the track, and they still can't make ends meet. And that's a real shift in the demographic of people that we're serving over the last few years. We've extended beyond just providing financial support to individuals to really trying to support people in the context of the railway family. And we're doing that through holding events for the retired community. People often say that feeling of railway family, they really miss that when they retire. And so we're providing opportunities to bring people together to talk about railway stuff, because the conversation always rightly goes in that direction, but to bring people together for some interesting days. And we've also started a befriending service, because if mobility then becomes an issue and you can't get out of the house to go to those sorts of events, then our research has showed that there's a real need for those personal connections. And so we're always on the lookout for volunteers who would love to sit and talk about railway stuff to someone who may be unable to leave the house but has had many exciting and memorable years in the industry. Or indeed, if you know of a lonely older person who would benefit from having some befriending phone calls, then do visit our website and take a look.
Loneliness is described as like one of the new cancers, isn't it? It's a real issue for some people, and that sounds fantastic. My dad, ex-railwayman who's retired now, actually, I think this is, you're onto something there, because they do it of their own accord. The old lags who used to work at Gateshead Shed decades ago meet up like once every 8 weeks or whatever, just go for a pint and a chat, and you know, like you say, talk about railways, talk about how it used to be, you know, how so-and-so doing, and do you remember when, and the age they're at, the numbers are dwindling, and you know, they have those conversations too, and it's really lovely. Actually, they still have a connection to the railway, and
yeah,
you know, maybe that never leaves you when you've worked all your life.
No, that's right, and that's what we're trying to do, is to make some of those reconnections for people who might have lost that since they you know, retired from the industry.
Love it. Oh well, I'll definitely be promoting that one.
And amazingly, on the charter train that we talked about earlier, where we met Pete, there were some retired railway people actually enjoying the day out and contributing back to RBF by buying tickets. But one guy actually called me over, and he'd got a photograph I'd taken of him 20 years ago that I remember taking it because it was on my birthday, and I had to stay sober for the day to take the photo because it was on the depot. But he'd kept it, and it was a key moment. And he was with his managing director at the time, and he said, what a great bloke he was as well.
It's fascinating, isn't it, Tony? Because that's almost going right back to the start, because 1851, did you say it was
1858
was founded, which at that time, no NHS, you know, no real kind of pension provision, no kind of general provision from the state per se. Now we've got supposedly all of that and supposedly well-paid jobs, and we've still got people suffering. So what a good job you're there, really, I guess.
Yeah, it's a really, really rewarding role. It's great to be at the forefront of the railway family looking after itself in the way that I think lots of people say that they love that feeling of family in the railway. I completely recognise that from my years in Network Rail, and it's really nice to be there to help people as best we can. So part of what we need to do is to get out there to make sure that everybody knows we exist, because as you said, not everybody does.
Yeah.
Some people are sort of vaguely aware of our existence, but not as many as we would like. So part of what we're trying to do currently is to, you know, up our profile so that people know they can come to us, and we'll see if we can help.
So meanwhile, we move back to trains are still running every day, sort of. I've literally hot-footed it from doing a Radio 4 interview where they started by quoting how many trains were cancelled in the last year, which was a bigger number than I expected, though they hadn't gone into all the reasons, some of which are because there's an industrial dispute going on. So they kind of forgot to mention that, which, so waste half the interview filling them in. But, you know, you've been involved in roles across the industry where making the trains happen has been key to your job. And I see people who are not happy with the railways saying, well, basically the people at the top don't care, really, you know, or those kind of things when they've had a bad day. Tell us what it feels like on the day when it's bad.
Bad days are really hard. They're really hard when bad days are things outside of your control, but they're equally hard when they are things that are inside your control, and you kind of know that. Railway performance for me is relentless day-to-day, minute-by-minute attention to detail by everyone. Railway performance does not happen. There's too many moving parts in the railway for it to be, you know, a simple thing. There is no silver bullet for performance. God knows I spent enough years looking for one and never found it. But it is relentless attention to detail by people who care, and I think people do care. I think there's always lots of other things to distract you, but when I think about it now, I think I'd probably liken railway performance to a slightly naughty toddler. You have to keep your eye on it all the time, and if you take your eye off it for a minute, it disappears off and does something that you really didn't want it to do. And so, you know, the industry has to find the time and the space in all the other debates and big topic discussions to be relentlessly focused on that stuff, because in all the years I've been on the railway, what people fundamentally want from it has not changed. They want a train to run, they want it to run on time. And if that can't happen for some reason, they want to know about it and to be looked after. And that's kind of the top and bottom of it. And I think if we focus on those core activities and make sure that those core activities are properly resourced and managed, then train performance stands a chance of coming right.
When you see people saying things like, oh, typical X, they don't really care about their passengers, that must really hurt to the people who have sweated the day before or have woken up at 4 o'clock in the morning to see if they've got a railway to run their trains on, or has yesterday's problem been sorted. And to see people saying, well, they don't really care, that's just typical of them.
Yeah, that does hurt. I think it's part of what we do, though. I think, you know, I've always thought the railway is not, it's not for the faint-hearted. You know, if you struggle to take criticism, this is not the role for you. And I don't think it's any different in lots of other services that we would all use.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not desperately interested in how somebody arranges the gas system, for example. You know, I happen to know a bit about it, but I just want it to work at the point of delivery.
Yeah.
And I think that's what people want from the railway. Mm. They're not interested when the railway descends into, well, that's them and this is that and somebody else. And I think, you know, we've all done it, haven't we? When water doesn't work, we criticise the water companies because they don't care. Well, I'm sure that they do, and I know that they do, but it's an easy thing for people to do for services, and that's why if we just make it work, people aren't interested in how it works behind the scenes, and nor should they be, really. We should stop wasting our time trying to explain to the general public who does what on the railway, because they don't need to know.
They shouldn't have to care. I love your analogy of the toddler, and it just got me thinking of taking that a little bit further. If that toddler goes a bit quiet, you ought to be suspicious, hadn't you, that there might be something going on, you know, and a bit like if your kids are playing in another room and everything goes quiet, you kind of think they're up to something. And I wonder if there's a bit of that going on at the minute with performance on the railway now in certain areas, that we might have maybe thought we'd spent a lot of money on something. You mentioned your time upgrading the West Coast. You know, we thought we'd done that, finally, job done, new railway in inverted commas, got things working, got new trains across the network more than ever before. You know, we're sat here in Northern's offices, for instance, they've got a fantastic array of wonderful new rolling stock. Kind of feels like we've upgraded a load of stuff and then maybe gone, oh, we can stop looking at that now, then we can focus on something else, and maybe even been distracted by some other things. Maybe we should be keeping our eye on those basics that you mentioned.
Yeah, I think the basics are always important and will never become unimportant. And I think, you know, if people are distracted by shiny things, that doesn't help. The railway is a system. And as I said, there's so many interconnecting parts that, you know, even if you do upgrade trains and upgrade track, it's the interaction between them that needs to work, and the interaction of all of the sum of the parts, really. And that's a big, massive three-dimensional jigsaw that makes people's heads hurt when you think about it too hard. The only way I've ever found for it to work is that if everybody focuses on doing their bit correctly, then you stand a chance of it all coming together. So yeah, relentless focus on the basics, really.
And the world's changed so much, hasn't it? I mean, funny memory from time when you and I used to work together in delivery mode, and comparing that to how it's changed now. I remember when video conferencing was new. And every now and then...
So do I.
Let's just reminisce for a minute. Every now and then you used to do the route exec meeting from this room in the mailbox in Birmingham, which is where I was based. And it had one of these new screens that are just commonplace now, aren't they? They're just in every room, and they've got a dodgy camera that sometimes doesn't work very well. But back then, they really very often didn't work very well. And I remember you used to do this every now and then, and then... I hope you won't mind me reminiscing this memory, Joe, but getting a bit frustrated when you didn't have certain people in the room to literally see the white of their eyes because they weren't in the room, they were on the camera. And it's different, isn't it? Communicating with your team, getting the best out of your team when they're on camera versus in the room. I just wonder how you'd kind of like reflect on that now that the world's changed, and how you've adapted. And do you miss those days where we used to always generally be in the same room together versus, you know, you got people all over the country, maybe even in different countries, trying to do business? And we do. We get on with it and we do it. But it's different, isn't it?
It is different. I think it's important for people to understand how the people in their team work. And I think, you know, when I think back to that, it was easy to say everybody needs to be in the room and see the whites of the eyes. I think it demands more sensitivity and more understanding from leaders now, actually, about what makes somebody tick. I think actually having over time become a real proponent of flexible working, even before the pandemic, one of the benefits of the pandemic, because there had to be some somewhere, was that, you know, lots of organisations finally got over themselves about working from home, because up until then people still believed that if you were working from home you were swinging the lead and it was all just some enormous con. Yet during that time, during the pandemic, people demonstrated that they could not only do their job, but actually do it really well and really effectively. So I think that's been a real positive, and certainly I've learned that you need to know what makes people work, because some people do work really well remotely. Others still do need that help and support of being around others. And I certainly do recognise, you know, the issue that lots of people have raised. For those who are coming new into the workforce, trying to learn what you need to learn about, not just about the topic or the thing that you're doing, but about how the world of work works and how people work together, that would be really, really hard to do remotely. So we have to just make sure that we do things that are appropriate for the setting in which we're trying to do it, really. There is not one size fits all.
Yeah. That connection to the railway is important, Tony, isn't it, as well? You mentioned your journey in, and I think you need that whinge every now and then as being a passenger as well as a railway employee.
That's it. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, that now Network Rail employees get the travel benefits that the rest of the industry in the top world have been getting for a long time. I hope a lot of them are actually getting out and trying the trains, because there was a period where you discovered that a lot of people that were working for Network Rail, say Milton Keynes, were actually just sort of driving into work, doing the job and driving home, and they weren't experiencing the joy and the misery of a good day and a bad day. And it was just a theory that they heard about almost. And so you've got to be using the product, haven't you, if you're part of it as well. Mm-hmm. So it's that mixture of being able to work from home, but also we need to get together and we need to try the product. And you can actually have a video conference from, you know, on your phone while you're out on the railway anyway. So it's learning to work in a different way, isn't it? The people all around the country that are supporting the railways, hopefully they're using the product.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I've taken the opportunity to introduce my team in the RBF to more railway stuff, because some of them have been there quite a long time, but actually explaining how things like, you know, leaves on the line, you know, the old classics that we're used to all of the time. You know, why is it like that? Why is it such a problem? And explaining how some of the industry structure is, so that when people come in and try to explain their situation and they're looking for help, then the team are a bit more informed about what is that role really like? What is it really like to work on the gate line?
Yeah.
What does a train conductor actually do? And that is, you know, our version of testing the product, I guess.
So interestingly, because we're recording this before the general election, but just generally, the railways is a thing that will be there for the new government to work on. And somebody said a couple of weeks ago, there's no PR for a politician in maintenance. You know, they like to open new things. They like to cut ribbons. If you give them a ribbon, they'll cut it before they ask what it is they're opening, probably.
Yeah.
And so we were both saying while we were setting up, we're hearing an awful lot more signal failures, infrastructure failures, points failures at the moment. And that's just basic maintenance. So whichever politician has got the badge, rail minister or transport minister on, hopefully they need to get the message, yes, there's no PR in maintenance, but that is the thing that the railway industry has got to get a grip on a bit, because it feels like it's a bit sort of been asked to hang on for a bit.
Yeah, I think I would say that there's probably good PR in good train performance, because it's been challenging for such a long time that anybody who could stand there with the badge on, as you say, and go, look, you know, we've turned it around, or we've stabilised it, or we're making it better. I think there, you know, there's probably PR in that.
I could never work out what number they would finally stand up and go, well done, you've got performance at a really good level now.
Yeah, I think you might have been hoping for a bit much with the whole well done thing.
Okay, yeah, right. A bit too optimistic with that. But yeah. I mean, short of 100%, I think they'd still argue and say, ah, but you're not measuring it right, because it's not really 100%, is it? It's time to five. Or, do you know what I mean? Yeah, they just never seem happy with that.
I think that's right. And on one level, you could agree with them, actually, because you don't want to turn on the electric in your house and it doesn't work one day out of 10. And they go, well, that's all right, because we've done 90%. You wouldn't find that acceptable, would you? So, you know, there's nothing wrong with aspiring to actually having a plan and a set of deliverables in the industry that work day in, day out. That's what it's supposed to do at the end of the day. You know, I think the difficulty is when people are travelling and are being disrupted more often than not, be that a small disruption or a large disruption, that's clearly untenable. Nobody would use a service like that.
Mm.
So, you know, we have to correct that first. And bearing in mind that people are, in some areas, travelling less frequently than they did before the pandemic, in a weird kind of way, I've not done the maths on this, but, you know, there's probably a chance that they might be actually disrupted more days because they're travelling less.
So yeah, if it goes, the impact is more when you're doing it less frequently.
So, you know, that probably is contributing to the feeling that things are, you know, not great.
I've definitely noticed recently, I'm travelling into London a lot at the minute. Going in the morning, I have some fantastic journeys. Bob on time, I get a seat, it's a nice clean train, you know, the aircon's working in, everything like that. Love it. Coming home at night, absolute bloody nightmare. Very often cancelled. Very often train after train cancelled, you know, so that you're really feeling the impact. And then when it finally turns up, it's late. And maybe it's dirty or maybe the aircon's working. I don't know what it is about evenings. It's like, I assume it's because things have gone wrong earlier on in the day and we've got that knock on and we've almost kind of... I mean, you used to head up the sort of the train plan for Network Rail, didn't you, Joe? I feel like we've lost the resilience, the ability to recover, because even after the pandemic, it feels like we've put all those trains back in again now. And that fire break, that ability to kind of take a breath, reset, let's get the evening peak back. We kind of set ourselves up to fail a little bit sometimes, I feel.
I think the resilience issue is a real one. And it's not just in terms of the train plan, in terms of having, you know, space in the timetable to recover, but you actually need the resources to do that.
Yeah.
You know, it's always been a challenge, you know, in my time on the West Coast. If something went wrong during the day, it was a real race to try and get it back in order to run an efficient evening peak. And I think we, you know, what you've just described as some of your journeys into London feel a bit like that.
Yeah.
That once something goes wrong during the day, because the plan is utilising the resources so efficiently, if I can call it that, with air quotes, then it stretches it to the point where it can't recover. And that's when, you know, things are bad for longer than perhaps would be ideal.
Yeah.
But it's difficult to justify having extra resources just lying around doing nothing just in case.
Really expensive resources.
Absolutely.
I've explained this many times to, like, graduate trainees all the way through to mayors, to even route directors, that these are the most expensive assets on the railway, drivers and trains themselves. They both relatively, you know, in their own ways, cost a lot of money. If you're going to have one sat around waiting just in case, and it wouldn't just be one, it's never just one, because where do you
and
put
it's never
them?
In the right place.
Never in the right place. West Coast Mainline, great example. Where do you put them? Oh, well, got one at Birmingham. Great, we've used him now. There's nobody there. Yeah. These things, the justification, as you say, it's huge, isn't it?
Yeah, it's always been a really big problem where to put any level of resilience, which is what, over time, brought me back to, rather than trying to create a fix for everything that might possibly go wrong and be resilient for all of those things, if we can actually just get it to work day in, day out, then you don't need to call upon those plans.
If it doesn't go wrong in the first place, then you shouldn't
need
all this.
Fix. Because you're right. You know, Murphy's Law says wherever you've put your spare loco or drivers, the issue will be 150 miles away, probably. So, you know, rather than try and cater for every eventuality, let's focus on just getting it to work day in, day out, and having a plan which stands a chance of working day in, day out, in that, you know, it's a good, robust plan that you can actually rely on getting out of the door every morning.
I remember if you flew to Charles de Gaulle in Paris, you'd fly over the TGV, TGV, should we be French?
Oh,
the TGV
nice.
Depot at Le Lundi. And if you arrived, flew over at midday, it was ramful of TGVs. And the new chief exec came in about 6 or 7 years ago, was it? And she said, I've just realised we could park a third of these permanently if we maintained them better and did it better and never need them. And we're just pouring money into having lots of things parked. And it's great because we've got a spare one if we need it, but we shouldn't be having tens and hundreds of them sitting around just in case. We should actually get it right in the first place. So there's a balance, isn't there, whether it's rolling stock or staff, that you need the right amount so you've just got a little bit of wriggle room. But somebody, and probably the taxpayer, is going to pay an awful lot of money if you have hundreds of spare drivers or hundreds of spare trains just sitting around on the off chance every now and then you might want to fire them up and get them to do something.
That's right. And if we did, Tony, people like you would be taking photographs of them and splashing it all over the front pages of the news saying what a terrible waste of taxpayers' money this is. So
indeed.
You're right. There is a balance in there between what I would call a robust plan and over-catering in terms of resilience, because you can't cater for everything.
So I sat in a control room a few years ago, I think it was in York, and it was lunchtime, and a guy in front of me said, I've just called up the last of our spare drivers for the day. So somebody was ill, somebody else had been taken ill during the day, and somebody, and they'd got spare ones, which, you know, people write to the newspapers and say, for goodness sake, why don't they have spare drivers?
They don't and just they, write to the newspapers and say, I hear it daily my travels, and people are outraged
there we
by
go.
This.
So they have a number of spare drivers that they think will be okay for the day, that you can justify to the taxpayer having sitting just in case. But on some days, you use them all. So, yeah, he sits 12 o'clock. By tea time, I've got nobody to call because I've called them all up, and that's it. So the passenger will say, well, you should have two more then. then for the next 300 days, they don't need those two, and you just pay their wages to sit on a sofa and read the paper. So it's a really complicated juggling act, isn't it, to have just the right resources, because you don't want the taxpayers saying, what a waste of money, and you don't want people buying tickets saying, why has my ticket gone up so much? You say, well, it's got loads of hundreds of spare staff just in case we might need them on Thursday.
Yeah, it is, and it's a task I don't envy the people who've got to make those decisions at the end of the day, because whatever you do, there'll always be an example where you've got it wrong, almost inevitably. I think one thing that people should bear in mind is that when you do change the basic plan, is that you should go back and look at those resilience resources again. Because if you change your basic plan and the robustness of the basic plan that you set out to do every day, then actually you've got to take the time to think about, right, now we're running, I don't know, more trains to Harrogate or whatever. Are our resources now, our spares, are they in the right place? Should we be moving them around? And sometimes people run out of time for that activity in the desperate rush to get the next bit of the plan working. And that, I think, is something that does need thinking about. And being open with people about, because there weren't many senior meetings that I was at where actually anybody explained what we were doing in terms of that. It always came up after the event, but actually going into the next timetable period with everybody's eyes wide open about what those resilience resources were, where they weren't, would probably have helped manage some expectations between the parties a bit better.
And I gather we're not there yet with that. I hear a lot lately about how, you know, we're 2 years on, depending on where you measure it from the end of the pandemic, and we're still rebuilding the plan, we're still amending the plan, we're still reacting to passenger numbers, you know, who's travelling where and when. And some of those changes are still coming really late notice, actually. We're not back to the industry timescales that we were for our train planning colleagues and for our diagrammers on the talk side. That's not quite there yet. So sometimes it'd be nice to have those conversations, but I don't think we're there yet. I think people are still in reaction mode at the minute rather than proactive, you know.
I could probably say this from the safety of having been involved in that element of it, is that the industry timescales are what they are for very good reason, yeah. But we shouldn't kid ourselves that they're massively reactive. We do live in an industry that needs to be able to react more quickly, I think, to demand, whether that's demand going up or demand going down. We need to be able to react to that. You know, if you went to the supermarket and they didn't have any cucumbers and they said, well, you know, thank you for your interest, we'll be back in 26 weeks with some new cucumbers, everyone would look at you like you were mad. So yeah. You know, we have to find a way in amongst all of that process and all the whizzo new sort of technology that could be out there to try and shorten some of those timescales so that the job still gets done right, absolutely needs to be done right, but can be more reactive than it probably has been in the past.
Yeah, it's about balance, isn't it? Because you're right, and I think it's another one. We mentioned working from home and how we kind of just had to get on with it during the pandemic. Well, one of the other things we had to get on with was just changing the plan more often. And we'd said for years previously we couldn't do that. We couldn't do that resiliently. We couldn't do it and still create a robust timetable. Well, what do you know? We did, kind of. We fudged it and people, you know, worked really hard and got on with it. But I think we almost created ourselves a bit of a problem there in a way, because now it's like, oh, well, you did it then, so you can do it again.
But in terms of planning, whether it's train planning or staff planning, which is all the same thing, let's throw an elephant into the room that we'll leave amongst this discussion. There are, as we speak, still industrial disputes going on. When they are solved, some people are going to get some back pay in a big lump sum. There is a strong feeling that quite a lot of people at that point will say, I'm going to retire now. And so it's out there. And I've spoken to senior managers who say, yeah, it's probably out there. But nobody's actually said, so what's the plan for when all those notices come in as soon as they get their pay packet with the big back pay check in and they've been hanging on because they were planning to take retirement? You know, there could be a crisis that's there, and we're talking about it now, and we'll replay this clip if it happens and say, see, in 2024 we said this is on the horizon. But it's the sort of thing, everybody's talking about it, but I don't know anyone has actually said, so what are we going to do when it happens?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because, you know, I recognise what you're saying. When I was, you know, involved in train planning, we did recognise to some extent that we have to constantly replenish the proportion of train planners. Slightly unofficially, Network Rail was like the trainee train planning department, really, because we would get people coming to us in junior roles. They would work through a number of different things, and then rightly, you know, they would disappear off to operators. Some operators are quite small, and therefore the benefit for them in investing in training programs for those kind of specialist roles, why would you do that when you could get them elsewhere? So I think there do need to be more conversations about that, because my view is you have to constantly feed in at the bottom, if I can metaphorically call it that, but into those starter roles, regardless of whether when you're actually doing that, you can see that there are jobs to move into, because by the time they've actually become productive, there will be. You can't see it, and that becomes difficult because somebody wants to see an actual vacancy that you're pushing someone towards. But my experience has always been stuff will happen, people will move on. You need to bring people into those starter roles, get them really competent, get them really confident, and then something will come up along the way that you can put them to exceptionally good use. And we've got to get better at seeing training and development at the starter roles in the industry as important as buying new trains, digging new holes,
cutting ribbons,
those things. Yeah.
We're terrible at it though, aren't we? We don't over-recruit. If anything, I mean, my whole career, I've been far more familiar with being told you've got to run at a vacancy gap, you know, because you're trying to deliver some sort of efficiency. Whereas actually, simultaneously and completely in contradiction, my whole career, I've been told about the age and demographic and all these people are going to retire. And that was even before COVID and the back pay. It was just everybody's old and they're all going to have these wonderful pensions.
I'll tell you a little story then. So a long time ago, and it was a long time ago because it was when I was doing my A-levels, and that was a long time ago.
We won't ask you how long.
No. I did a particular course in something called gerontology, which is the science of ageing. And they were absolutely adamant at that point that this demographic time bomb was coming, and they were absolutely right. So people have known about it across not just our industry, but across society more generally for many years. And I think many of the things that we see out there now are examples of that coming to pass. You know, the NHS being under intense pressure. It's because we've got a large percentage of the population coming to the sort of age where more health intervention is required. Care is another one. You know, education is at the other end because there's fewer and fewer children. So, you know, education is in some areas is having to get smaller. So the demographics of the population of the UK is a big feature that hasn't really played into our thinking in a very obvious way, in perhaps the way that it might. And that's, I think, is at the heart of what you've just said about drivers and other roles. You know, lots of people are getting to the age where they've had enough.
Or they haven't, and you can't plan for it anymore. Because the other thing that happened towards the start of my career, they changed the laws around retirement age.
Yes.
And no longer were we able to pinpoint when people would retire.
Yes.
And that was a massive change because, you know, workforce planning, you used to be able to say, well, here's a bunch of people. We know their date of birth because we are their employer. And we can now map that is when they're actually going to retire. You can't do that now. And people have all sorts of reasons for wanting to retire early, late, you know, have
and
a second career.
You can't ask them.
You can't ask them to retire.
No, but you can't even ask them, when were you thinking of retiring? So maybe we need to find a way of sort of asking people, you know, is there a question, you know, nationally in all sorts of roles that we can say to people, just out of interest, because it would help with us with our recruitment planning. Have you got any feelings whether you're thinking of working beyond the normal retirement age, going a bit early and taking the thing? We'd just like a survey, we could anonymise it or something, but, you know, all the industry would love to know what's in the mind of all those people. Because I was with the driver a couple of years back now, in his cab, officially, it was all allowed, who was past retirement age and was doing 2 days a week because he wanted to carry on driving, perfectly healthy, passed all the fitness tests. He said, so I do 2 days a week. I love it. Company find it very useful to have people like me who can do 2 days a week, and I'm happy to do any of the 2 days in the week. But that's what I do, and it's fab, and I love working.
We need more of that, by the way.
Yeah, and so, you know, so there's a thing, and he'd had the conversation. He'd been quite open with his employers. Can I stay on and do part-time working? They said, lovely, fantastic. He said, I'm prepared to be flexible. They said, you know, sign here, basically. So out of interest, because I'm looking at these two strong women who've forged their careers in the railway industry, and you're talking about working together, and we started this podcast celebrating the Women in Rail Awards, which are actually more about inclusion in the industry than just women now, because a lot of people have said, why on earth are they having awards? But there's no Men in Rail Awards. So there were an awful lot of men getting awards at that event, weren't there? So
there were.
It's much wider anyway. But inclusion and diversity and strong females, strong employees from different demographics are key to the future railways as well. So let's round this up a little bit. But, you know, the Women in Rail Awards, and you two have had careers where at some points you might have been sat in a room full of men and you, or at some events.
At some points.
And at some points, I remember going to a railway event and standing at the front doing something with someone, and they said, look, it is just a bunch of middle-aged white men. that is the room for. That's it. And I looked and I said, it's got to be what? No, you're right. So the industry
that's
still
changing. Hope you'd agree, Joe, that's changing. We're rarely the only women, or I find I am rarely the only woman in the room now.
Yes, I'd agree, yeah.
And that did used to be the case. I was often the only woman in the room.
When I first started, I was the only sort of frontline operations person for several miles in any direction that was a woman. So it was odd, strange, different back then. That's certainly not the case now.
That's not the case, and nor is it the case that you're even in such a minority at things like industry events, you know, conferences, award ceremonies and what have you. I think that suggests that it's flowing through from more frontline, as my career has progressed further away from frontline. I think it is changing. The thing I'd like to mention, though, is we touched on it with part-time work and is flexibility in that word, which is loads more of it about now, flexible work in various different forms. Love the idea of more part-time frontline roles, for instance, part-time train drivers, part-time conductors. Awesome. But what I'm hearing a lot about is flexibility that doesn't work both ways. So people want flexibility that suits them, but then they don't see the other side of it, that actually what's really difficult about flexibility, and I think we need to be honest about this, is bloody hard to plan for. If you're the line manager, the employer, the business, actually, if the flexibility is only one-sided, it's really hard to actually plan your business around that. And I think, again, I mentioned pendulum swinging earlier. That's another one where I think it's gone all the way one way. People have gone, I'm entitled to flexible work and I'm allowed to ask for it. I'm allowed to have it. Great. Fully support that, you should, but it's gone a bit too far at the minute, I think, and needs to swing back a little bit to almost going, well, first of all, just because you can doesn't mean you should, because actually for all sorts of reasons, you know, you might not need it anymore. I'll give you an example. This is better illustrated by an example. I was recently at a train operating company where they'd got a concentration of frontline staff who had interpreted the rules on flexible working quite specifically to be that if they could, then they should ask for it because the company had to say yes, which isn't quite what the law says, actually. The law says you can only say no if you've got a good reason to, if you can't accommodate it. Not quite the same thing as you have to say yes. They also had a bunch of people who'd applied for flexible working for really specific reasons around what I think logically are time-bound things. So, for instance, you've got a terminally ill relative that you're caring for. Of course, we would want all of our railway businesses to support our employees in doing that. It's absolutely something we would want to be supportive of. But it does have an end point by definition. And when that end point was coming, they were going, no, I'm a flexible worker now. And not revisiting the conversation to say, well, hang on a minute, I thought you wanted it for a time-bound reason. Don't you now want to revisit that because things have changed? So that's just a little bit of an example there where I think nothing to do with women in rail per se, because they're not gender-specific examples, of just the world has changed. It's good to be flexible, but flexibility works kind of both ways for me, I think.
Yeah, I think organisations have to think about how flexible working does or doesn't work for them, because it doesn't work for everybody. And I think sometimes people feel pressured into saying yes to flexible working because of how people have interpreted the law without necessarily thinking through all the consequences of it. So I think we should always encourage line managers to be really clear about what does and doesn't work, and not being afraid to say it doesn't work if there are really sound reasons for that. I think for a while, particularly immediately after the pandemic, the employment market had shifted to the point where some employers were so desperate they'd have taken anybody on any terms, and because that's settling down a bit, I think that's contributing to your feeling that the pendulum's gone a bit too far. But I think at the heart of this for me is about a really clear understanding between managers and the people that they manage about what we're here to do and how can we make that most effective for both parties. Because what works for one won't work for another.
Yeah.
And that's where people have to know their teams really well and not just assume that because it's worked over there, it will work here. No two cases are ever the same, really. We have done great things on gender diversity in the railway, but we've still got a long way to go on other areas of diversity. You know, there's very few meetings that I walk into where I think, yes, this group of people is representative of UK PLC and, you know, the body of passengers that we serve. It isn't. And I think only when we get to the point where we truly represent the demographic of the UK, then we will be properly creating and planning for a system that meets those needs. Yeah. Because we're always slightly missing some things because we're not as diverse as we need to be.
And I was just going to say, the sort of approach to being more flexible in the working week, people need to reflect on how good that is for them, and it's a great thing to be able to have, but there are people across the industry who can't have it because of their job, and they need to be careful just how they explain it. Because I have seen railway crews through COVID and on staff forums and things since saying, you know, of course they don't have to come in every day if they don't want to, so maybe it's badly explained. But when we're sort of currently, or the industry is saying to staff, we're going to have to discuss your terms and conditions, you know, don't do it from a position of, because I get nearly everything I want, or, you know, my life's really flexible but yours can't be. It's an industry that relies on a lot of people who virtually are clocking in and clocking out, like the old manufacturing industry still, so that has to be respected as well.
But equally, there are good examples of where flexibility can be made to work in roles which traditionally people think, oh no, you can't have flexible train drivers. How can you have a train driver that only works 2 days a week? I mean, people would have sort of looked at you funny a few years ago. But I think you have to think more laterally now about how you can make flexibility work in any role in the industry, because that's how we're going to finally crack some of the wider diversity issues, which we haven't quite sorted yet.
And explaining it better is definitely key. You know, when somebody says, oh, you're having 9 months off for a rest, you know, you're having 12 months off maternity leave, that's nice, you're gonna have your feet up, you know, like it's a rest, and obviously it's not, it's really bloody hard work. So maybe we just need to work a bit harder at understanding what each other's roles are on the railway, and then we'd probably also encourage people to move around more, which is a good thing, because if you don't know about different roles, the railway's huge, and you know, you might not have even understood that certain things exist. So more explanation of things is what I'm after.
And that comes back to the family thing, which we started with sort of with RBF, because we're rapidly running right out of time now. But that family thing again, that if you're involved in the family, then the family might be interested to know what you do for a job or whatever. Or it might be really good if you just chat together, you know, did you have a good day at work, whatever. So, you know, I've seen top managers having a good chat with people in the ticket office or in the cab or whatever, you know, and that's always been the lesson to new incomers into the industry in senior positions. Make sure you get out on the patch, talk to people. The more they know you, the more they'll talk to you, and they'll share their issues with you rather than just griping about it in the pub at the weekend with their mates or whatever. So think family at times as well, I think.
Yeah, I think one of the most powerful questions you can ever ask is, so tell me about what you do.
Yeah.
Because people love to explain what they do, even if they're quite grumpy about it, they still love to do it. And you learn so much from that simple question that can really open doors, I think.
Yeah. Railway people love to tell you what they do, especially let me make you a brew and let me tell you what
I do. If there's a brew involved, it's going to be a long one. Settle in.
We are right out of time. For people who've been listening, thank you for enduring the world's loudest air conditioning fan. If you wonder where your fares go in Northern, it's actually to pay for a constantly running fan that nobody knows how to switch off.
And apologies if you heard various doors banging. We are in an operational railway environment, actually, just behind the scenes. Or if you heard any slurping and swallowing, certainly from me, because I've managed to go through half a bottle of water in the time we've been sat here. I'm absolutely
boiling. Well, I think I did very well. I didn't sneeze, which was my greatest fear. So
well done.
It all went really well.
It all went very well. And this is the good bit now, because I'm going to ask Anna-Jane if she can remember the email address. Anna-Jane, email address for people to come back with comments and things.
pllines@gmail.com. pllines@gmail.com.
See, you can do the voiceover voice as well now. Thank you, Joe, for your time, and we'll be back with episode 6 probably sooner now, because we've got a little bit of time coming up where we can get a few more things done. So we'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you want to know any more about the RBF, or you work in the railway industry and think RBF could help you in some way, then go to railwaybenefitfund.org.uk. And of course, RBF's on all the usual social channels, X, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn.